Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
This is The Reasonable Voice, blog talk radio, where we believe everything is political and our problems are due to a lack of education and being informed about the issues. We look into the arts, finance, and humanities to learn the solutions, because The Reasonable Voice, blog talk radio, comes to you to connect the dots between politics and finance, humanity and world peace, and the arts, in a way that encourages all to think for themselves, so the best political and life choices are made by all. With artistic overtones, The Reasonable Voice is an advocate for a peaceful and prosperous world filled with creativity and political unity. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, and my guest today is Justin A. Serafin, the Director of Preservation Initiatives and Engagement at Preservation Virginia. Hello, Justin. How are you?
Good morning, Marcello. I'm fine, thanks.
Great to talk to you again. I know you've been on Blog Talk Radio a couple of times with some with fascinating people with you, but we're going to go solo today. I know that you are, first of all, as the Director of Preservation Initiatives and Engagement, does that mean you're the road man or what?
Well, yeah, partly. I work on, at Preservation Virginia, I work on all of our statewide educational programs and also projects in the field. I work with a field representative, Sonia Ingram, who is based actually down in Danville, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And the two of us are, we really are the kind of the first line of defense, if you will, or the first people that anyone having issues might contact.
Uh-huh. Gotcha. And so what? If someone calls up, and I say this, well, I'll stop trying to be coy. There is a drive that has been going on at least until the beginning of March, the endangering list to get people on or sites applied for preservation, historical preservation. I guess I'm kind of muffing that up. But tell me, what is that? What you're most occupied with at the moment?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Marcello. Actually, due yesterday on March 3rd, nominations were due for our annual most endangered historic sites list.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like you say, it helps to focus our work in the field for the following year. But basically, what this list does, it's, as I said, it's the, we accept nominations, and then once listed, historic sites or landscapes, cultural resources, and it's not necessarily limited just to a physical structure. Once listed, the whole idea with the list is to basically raise awareness that the resource, A, exists, B, is threatened in some way, and C, the listing sort of advocates for workable solutions for all parties involved to work together, explore alternatives, and within reason, come up with the best historic preservation-minded solution.
Mm-hmm.
I should add that the purpose of the list, I mean, it sounds rather ominous, in the most endangered sites list, and it is in a way, but the point is not to punish or shame or sort of point fingers at anyone or any organization or any locality. It's really more about, again, raising awareness about the issue and really encouraging dialogue. And I think sort of your intro here to the show, you know, the notion of transparency in process, that's all very important, and that's really that's one of the main goals of the list, is really to promote dialogue, transparency, and again, come up with reasonable solutions.
It sounds like this list is great for launching a preservation project, but does it ever also, maybe surprise is not the word, but as you guys are driving about the Commonwealth of Virginia or in your headquarter office, do the applications to for a site to be put on the endangered list ever surprise you? Are you, in other words, do you ever have a, wow, I didn't know about that moment?
Yes. Let's face it, the state of Virginia covers a
pretty
rather
big
large land area.
Yeah.
And, you know, we are a statewide organization. Preservation Virginia is a private, nonprofit organization. We have counterparts in state government in the form of the Department of Historic Resources, and so we collaborate with them often, regularly. But right, Virginia is a big state. there's a lot of territory to cover, and yes, there are nominations sometimes that come through that. For sites that we weren't aware of. But this year we got quite a number of nominations, some multiple nominations for the same site. But I've just tallied all of them, and we've got about the submission list is about 16 different sites from around the state.
Wow.
Represented. And so from there, our selection committee will assess all of those and determine the final list. The final listing that will be made public, and that will be with much media fanfare in mid-May.
Okay.
So everything has come in, and we'll process all of those, and the list will finally be announced in mid-May.
And you expect, I guess, to narrow down from the 16, or?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
And there's really no set number.
Uh-huh.
Each nomination is really evaluated specifically based on the sort of the degree of threat, but also, very importantly, the degree of support more locally for the project. And so a successful listing really encourages further dialogue, but it sort of presupposes that there is some dialogue happening already.
Gotcha.
Right? Does that make sense?
Yes, of course. You know, we talk about the parts of Virginia, and I've driven all over Virginia long before I lived in the state, as a matter of fact. It's a great historical place, as we all know, and different trips down from New York to come to D.C. and then drive sort of a history driving lesson through Virginia. I must admit, in some places, perhaps I shouldn't mention the cities, you get a CD about how the Civil War went, and it's not quite the way I I read about it, but I find that interesting too. But there's one piece of and all this is leading to a question of which is basically, do most of your requests for preservation come from rural areas as opposed to urban? But before that question gets asked, there's this long little strip that ends in a point in the southwest piece or corner of Virginia that most of us forget about, but I guess a person in your position doesn't. Do you get over that way? I mean, it's like over toward Kentucky and Tennessee, isn't it?
Right. Way down there in southwest Virginia, sort of beyond Roanoke. Some people say, oh, Roanoke, Southwest Virginia, but there's quite a bit
of Virginia beyond that.
Yes, we do. And in fact, last year, one of our most endangered sites listings was in Wythville.
Uh-huh.
It was the Edith Bowling Wilson birthplace.
Uh-huh.
House Museum.
Uh-huh.
Right in Wythville. And then they've actually been very active. Some of the publicity from that has really helped them. At our last statewide conference, which was in October, actually in Roanoke,
mm-hmm.
The Wilson birthplace, they won a contest or sort of, well, performance sort of contest called Preservation Pitch. That we do at our statewide conference every year, which is sites apply. Three finalists then get to make a 3-minute pitch presentation on stage, and then the in support of their project, and then the audience votes right then, and the winner is chosen. And so the Edith Bowling Wilson site won last year's pitch. So, you know, it's great. It's wonderful to, A, sort of be in touch with the further reaches of the state, and B, to really see our involvement with sites like this continue, you know, from endangered sites to Preservation Pitch. And it's a great way to engage and keep engaged with communities across the state. You know, where our headquarters, we're based in Richmond. I'm based in Charlottesville. I mentioned Sonia; she's in Danville. But you know, for the most part, we're in Central Virginia, and so we really do, especially with the most endangered sites list, really do try to solicit nominations from afar.
And I guess in every case, we did answer that, or did we? Did we answer that you get more requests from rural areas than urban?
We didn't. No, we did not.
Okay.
I would say it's probably skewed slightly rural, but there are plenty of submissions that come from towns and cities that, you know, that I wouldn't consider strictly rural. Oftentimes there are, for instance, there have been sites in Richmond, like the Libby Hill Overlook, which is actually sort of a scenic vista view shed kind of issue, threatened with development. That was in Richmond. Occasionally entries from more urban parts of Northern Virginia. But I would say a slight majority of the listings are skewed toward the rural.
And that might also be that with, sad to say, I'm conjecturing, but it might also be that in urban areas, a lot of our history has already been, what's the best way to put it, to say, at the very least, bypassed through construction and maybe lost to construction. Whereas in the rural areas, there may be more of a chance to still save our past. Is that perhaps correct?
Yeah, I think you're on to something there. I think the most common overarching threat to historic resources that we see, whether inner city or, you know, quasi-urban or rural, really is the sort of spread of development. In more rural situations, occasionally you get situations that are more demolition by neglect. But then again, that can happen with properties in the middle of the city as well. So it's development pressures and threats, demolition by neglect. But sometimes there are real immediate, imminent threats of development. Sometimes the threats are further off. They're sort of longer term types of things. I think of a site in particular that we've been involved with It was on, I think, the 2009 list, and that's the Booker T. Washington National Monument, National Park site in Franklin County, about an hour southeast of Roanoke. And that is a case where there's this historic site, and it was listed because of threat of development adjacent to the park's land holdings. And I think the point I'd like to make with that listing is that once something's listed, it's sort of always on there. It's something that we're always trying to keep up on and advocate for. And you know, along those lines, that park site is still under threat of development in that region.
So you are you saying that once it's on the list, you don't just try it for a limited amount of time. It remains something that at least is in your peripheral vision.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I would say it's not often that a listed site is actually lost. Thankfully. Hopefully, that's a testament to the. To the value and usefulness of the list, you know, that it's definitely not a lot of properties that we lose as a result of the listing. It happens, certainly. But yeah, the endangered sites list, like I say, each year it comes out, it sort of focuses our work, but it's also sort of our it's almost our portfolio of sites and properties around the state that we remain engaged with.
And I guess a large part of that, you've already said that keeping engaged is involving the community, the local community. If they have a stake in it, if they want it to happen, then keeping them involved in the process helps you accomplish what you want to accomplish at Preservation Virginia, yes?
That's exactly right. I mean, what you've hit on is sort of the main structure of the program and really Preservation Virginia's work in the field, and that's that we are a statewide organization, but we can't be in every community at the local level working every detail of every historic preservation threat across the state.
Yes.
So what that means is, and as we mentioned with some of the sort of criteria that make for a successful listing, is that we're advocating for helping to organize efforts at the local level, so that you know we can help inform that, be a part of that, but that there is a more localized charge working on the project. You're exactly right.
Excellent. I don't want to step off the point, but you've mentioned Danville a couple of times, and I know recently in the news, of course, we've known about the West Virginia water and now North Carolina coal ash and so forth, but there was some mention briefly in the news about Danville water. And since you have an associate there, it just makes me wonder, are you running into, it's because I've never asked you this, it's one of the things while you're out there trying to preserve our history, our past, this kind of potential contamination, do you ever run into any brick walls from the corporate need to make money?
Well,
I just think, you know, I just think of it because we're surrounded here in the mid-Atlantic states, and there is some talk about the Danville water and the water in Crozet. And, you know, so just curious, does that ever become... Is that too loaded a question?
It's a loaded one. I mentioned the threat of development, and a big piece of that
yes.
is various corporate interests.
Yes.
You know, an issue down in the Danville region was a big issue in last year's General Assembly was the a bill relating to uranium mining.
Yes.
And so things like that, you know, the uranium mining threat, the water pollution in the Dan River as a result of coal ash, these are where issues like that intersect with the sort of heritage tourism, historic resources, sort of historic landscape, where these things intersect with us, you know, we have some involvement. At a certain point, things move more to the sort of ecological and kind of land conservation side of things. But that's to say, we have many statewide and regional partners who we work with on those. On those types of issues, where it's certainly, I mean, we're historic preservationists, and where we sort of run out of our expertise, and we need to let other organizations take the lead, on things more environmental and ecological. Certainly, you know, we do that, but support where we can, and it's a good strategy. It works on some of these larger issues, and we see it work with most endangered sites listings, where a coalition of organizations from the local to the regional to the national level, really an organized coalition working for the same purpose. And emphasized and coordinated, has quite a bit of sway in local, state, and national government. So there are issues like that. There's the last year the National Trust for Historic Preservation. So basically, our national counterpart, private nonprofit, National Trust for Historic Preservation, I'm sure everyone knows of it. They too an endangered sites list as well. And last year, we at Preservation Virginia, the statewide, we were in support of and helped to launch the media arrangements for one of their listings last year, which was the James River viewshed off the Colonial Parkway.
Oh yes.
There's the threat of multi-story electrical towers that Dominion wants to build across the Thames, and so that's an issue that's been taken up, on the national level by the trust, and so we certainly it's in our backyard. We work with and have been and continue to work actually weekly with that coalition on that issue.
Okay. We're going to take a break, everybody. This is fascinating. Justin Serafin, Director of Preservation Initiatives and Engagement, is our guest today. We'll take a short break. Stay with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about the salmon cemetery and farm land, tobacco barns, and not to forget Rosenwald schools. We'll be right back with Justin Serafin trying to save the history of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Reasonable Voices Blog Talk Radio. My guest today, Justin A. Serafin, Director of Preservation Initiatives and Engagement with Preservation Virginia. I wonder, we've kind of jumped right into some specific examples, but Justin, can you give us a sort of overall mission, goal, philosophy of Preservation Virginia? How you guys operate on a I mean, you know, what's the big arc here?
Sure. Well, interestingly, this year, 2014, is actually Preservation Virginia's 125th birthday.
Uh-huh.
We've been around for a long time. We're actually the first statewide historic preservation organization in the country. We celebrated last week with a legislative reception in Richmond. Governor McAuliffe actually dropped by to say hello, which was great.
Good.
But in 125 years, certainly as an organization and sort of, you know, changes in mission and as a result of societal, economic factors, et cetera, Preservation in Virginia has moved from a predominantly property-owning organization to one doing the kind of work that I'm specifically charged with, and that is being out in the field, just advocacy, really being out advocating for sites, you know, from the individual to the sort of, you know, thematic, and we'll talk about Roosevelt schools a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
But one point that I think is very important to make about historic preservation and what that means here in the 21st century is that that old model of historic house museums and sort of freezing time in the past,
uh-huh,
or when it comes to any sort of change, the old idea that historic preservation is just about saying no to change and being, you know, obstructionist to sort of any kind of change whatsoever,
mm-hmm,
I would argue that in the 21st century model, that's not what historic preservation is. It's,
uh-huh,
actually it's more of, it's about smart development, smart growth. It's about strategically saving that which came before to help, mm-hmm, influence and enrich, you know, that which is going to come come in the future.
Yes.
And it's about preserving sense of place while acknowledging that projects, historic preservation projects, development in general,
mm-hmm,
that these things cost money, that, you know, we are in we are all sort of working within our economic framework,
mm-hmm,
and that the notion of doing something just because it's quote unquote the right thing to do, you know, oftentimes doesn't float as an argument, or at least doesn't convince people,
mm-hmm,
as an argument. And so, just to quickly mention that the sort of economic development value of historic preservation is something that we're really trying to emphasize more, especially in whether it's the Virginia's General Assembly, whether it's, you know, the congressional level, the idea that historic preservation, things like the Main Street program, the tourism industry, heritage tourism,
mm-hmm,
that all of these things that are, they're all parts of historic preservation, and that they're economic drivers.
Mm.
We just released, beginning of the year, phase one of a three-part economic impact study,
uh-huh,
on historic tax credits in the state of Virginia.
Hmm.
And it's been very well received. It's a very useful tool for demonstrating to whether it's a local government, whether it's at the statewide level, demonstrating that rehabilitation tax credits, the idea of getting tax credits for historically National Register eligible properties, in this, that there are jobs created, that, you know, money is pumped into the economy,
mm-hmm,
et cetera, et cetera. So it's this type of discussion where we want to, it's more than just about doing the right thing, you know, for history, mm-hmm. but there really is an economic argument to be made. So anyhow, I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, that's a terrific answer to the question. And I'm sure, like different fingers on a hand have served different purposes and working together helps the hand function. You must have, different approaches for different people and different situations, because one size just doesn't fit all. That's,
you're exactly right.
Yeah.
And you know, for when you're dealing with you know, town or city governments or county governments that are really strapped for cash, and you know, maybe are not approaching things from a historic preservation point of view. Maybe they have a series of historic school buildings mm-hmm. in their portfolio that need to be modernized or replaced or rebuilt. When it comes to sort of the budget line, I think people automatically sort of think that it's cheaper to tear down and rebuild something new. I mean, studies show that that's not the case, that mm-hmm. there's embodied energy in a historic structure that, and things are better built, first off, mm-hmm. but that the notion of adaptively reusing structures can be cheaper in the long run, more mm-hmm. efficient. But it's about helping to sort of change the mindset.
Yes.
And so it's things like this economic impact study and others, and successful, being able to point to successful examples of adaptive reuse
uh-huh.
structures like that, that can help make the point with, you know, whomever it is, whether it's a school board, whether it's a county board of supervisors that's looking to modernize or replace a school. To be able to point to those concrete examples is really important.
Excellent. I know, moving on now to some specifics, perhaps, we probably made a big media splash with all the ins and outs and inconsistencies and on and offs of the Western Bypass, with VDOT sort of planning to plow through the Salmon Cemetery. We've heard a lot about that, and I do want to touch on it for a bit. But first, a couple of projects that are probably lesser known to the general public, saving the Rosenwald schools, for instance, and some states have covered bridges. We have tobacco barns. Can you give us some information about, well, what a Rosenwald school is, first of all, and how does your office and you get involved, and why?
Sure. last year, on our 2013 list, we included a thematic listing for Rosenwald schools in Virginia. This was really prompted by when I joined Preservation Virginia about 13 months ago. One of the very first things that I worked on was a Rosenwald school in Bath County that was facing imminent demolition.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of prompted me and us to look into Rosenwald schools a bit more, and eventually ended up with this listing. And this is an incredible resource in the Southeast. Rosenwald Schools, Julius Rosenwald, CEO of Sears Roebuck Company.
Yes.
Here's a great common thread here. We mentioned the Booker T. Washington National Monument
yes.
site earlier. Well, Booker T. Washington basically conceived of this program, brought Julius Rosenwald on board to help with funding. And this was a rural African-American school building program in the Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
From the late teens to the early 1930s, more than 5,500 schools were built in the Southeast U.S. Mm. Virginia saw there were about 360-something Rosenwald schools built in Virginia. And so it was sort of delving into this really just, it just became this fascinating topic. And there's just so many connections to other things that we're working on. I mean, mm-hmm. just the notion of late 19th and early 20th century African American history in Virginia. You know, we're dealing with that in terms of the Jesse Scott Sammons Farmstead site here in Albemarle County. Mm-hmm. Likewise, in these rural communities throughout Virginia, it's 360-something schools.
Wow.
And so what we're hoping to do is we're in the process of planning how to basically rediscover and inventory and assess the surviving schools in Virginia. And then the next step is really to sort of figure out the best way to advocate for their reuse, you know, mm-hmm. so to save them if they're threatened, and most of them are.
Uh-huh.
We estimate that there are maybe 30 or 35% of them still standing in the state.
Mm.
So it's a daunting project, but it's also one that does have boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Some work's been done. Department of Historic Resources has done some work. There exists at the national level, at the National Trust for Historic Preservation, they do have a Rosenwald Initiative, and I've been working with them. That's been really rewarding to sort of see how they're handling this in that whole 5,500 school across the Southeast realm. So there's support for moving forward on the project. A couple of weeks ago, we had a fantastic networking and planning event at John Tyler Community College, mm-hmm. and had no fewer than 10 or 12 different Rosenwald schools represented.
Wow.
So these are organizations, local, you know, organizations, community groups, in some cases, organized to save their local school. We had 75 people in attendance, so it was. There's definite need and interest in the project, and so we're really excited about it.
And I guess it's only fair play, you know, what goes around comes around, because I'm assuming, given the time frame, if you've mentioned, in which these Rosenwald schools were built, was in part, at least, response to that people of color weren't allowed in certain schools, and even if they did, their education stopped at the eighth grade. Families had to send black children north to finish their education, and so this was I'm guessing in part a response to how do we solve that problem. We build schools in our rural areas and educate our children. Is that too fine a point?
No, that's exactly it. It's fascinating the sort of trajectory. And even involving the historic sites here in greater Charlottesville,
uh-huh.
that's the narrative from sort of post-emancipation, and we see communities growing up like Hydraulic Mill and Carsburg, where the Sammons site is located.
Yes.
A little bit further out, there are a handful of Rosenwald schools in Albemarle County. And then we sort of move a little bit later in the early 20th century, and then we're looking at what our colleagues over at the Jefferson, the African American Heritage Center, the Jefferson School,
yes.
are working on, and
yes.
kind of pulling this whole story together.
Yes.
You know, looking at this narrative of the sort of history of African American education in Virginia, it's It's all so interwoven, it's fascinating.
Yes. Listen, we probably need to go, but before we go, can you give us some contact information for Preservation Virginia for people who, I mean, it may be too late this year to apply for an endangered, to be on the endangered list, but at least to communicate about Rosenwald schools and other historical sites that people are discovering and have an interest in and want you to know about, etc. Let us know how we get in touch with you.
Yes, surely. Yeah, Rosenwald Schools, the Tobacco Barns Project in Southside, Virginia, our annual conference, all of these things. You can find information about them at our website, which is very simply preservationvirginia.org. And it's preservation in Virginia written out, .org.
Gotcha. Now, what about conferences like the one recently at Tyler Community College? Those are open to the public and announced, or how does that go?
Yes, for the most part. Certainly, our next Rosenwald event will likely be the public launch of the program, and so that we will want as many people there as possible.
Yes.
And so for events like that, yeah, information can be found on our website, and as well, we have a very active Facebook page.
Oh, okay.
So for anyone really interested, I would suggest liking Preservation Virginia on Facebook, and that's a really great way to see both the sort of formal projects that we're working on, but also we'll post, if we go to visit the site somewhere and find interesting things, we'll post about it.
Oh, wow.
You get to sort of see our travels around the state almost in real time. So definitely Preservation Virginia on Facebook.
All right. Well, excellent. Thank you so much, Justin, Justin Serafin, everyone, Director of Preservation Initiatives and Engagement at Preservation Virginia, has been our guest today, and we certainly appreciate that and all his information and updates. Always great to talk to you, Justin.
Marcello, thank you so much.
All right, then. Everyone, stay with us, though. We'll be back. The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me today are technical support creative catalyst and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Danielle Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. I've been talking to Justin A. Serafin. We're going to say goodbye to Justin, but to everyone else, stick around, and we'll be right back. The Reasonable Voice connects the dots. The mission of The Reasonable Voice and The Reasonable Voices, working together on our blog talk radio shows, is connecting the dots between politics and finance, need for education, humanity and world peace, and the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination for equality opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world, embracing creativity and political unity as solutions. Although understandably proud of our radio content, we must now pay special tribute to our most recent guests, legislators of tomorrow, instrumental in passage of HB 206 in Virginia House of Delegates, Saving Our Children from Bullyside, film documentary producer of Bullies and Friends, advocates for Equal Rights Amendment and its passage of SJ 78, Preservation History, the Southern Environmental Law Center, county and city government heads, Alzheimer's Association Central and West Virginia Chapter President and CEO, and the pragmatic family healthcare charity Interfaith Humanitarian Sanctum, selected by the University of Virginia Department of Anesthesiology for their holiday charity, donating full-day meal packets to the family assistance IHS provides to the families of patients. Quoting Lynn T. Heath, executive assistant to George F. Rich, Chair, Department of Anesthesiology, "We traditionally take donations for holiday presents for our bosses, and last year our administrator suggested we contribute to a charity instead on his behalf. One of the staff members nominated IHS because of the caring connection to our patients. It was too late to complete the project before the holiday break, and weather delays and staff travel pushed it into February. But any day is a great day to do this. IHS makes it easy with clear and comprehensive instructions and hints for shopping and assembly. As university employees, we are given 16 hours to spend in community service activities, so it's easy for any department to do something similar. It's a project that can work with almost any amount of money or time available, since it's easily scaled to the resources at hand." Unquote. Where two or three are gathered, reasonable Americans believe in supporting all Americans. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen, support, and share The Reasonable Voice with your friends. We are now accepting offers for your company or organization to advertise with us, and welcome new sponsors for The Reasonable Voice. To apply, please email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com.
Thank you for joining us today and every day, and recommending us to all your friends, both online and offline. And please download our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.